This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our interview with Ralph Reed, head of the Christian Coalition, which was scheduled for today, had to be rescheduled. We expect to have it for you tomorrow. You know, I'm sometimes stunned by the things I don't know about the people I interview. For instance, back in 1989, I interviewed a poet named Michael Ryan. His first volume of poetry, published in 1974, had won the Yale Series of Younger Poets Award and a National Book Award nomination. I was particularly struck by a poem in his 1989 collection, God Hunger. Before I tell you more about Ryan, I want you to hear that poem. It's about how, as a child, his father forced him to play a game called Milk the Mouse, in which the father takes the child's pinky and squeezes it hard between the father's thumb and forefinger until the child can't stand it anymore and screams for the father to stop. The poem has the rhyme scheme of a villanelle.
He'll pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking. The floor lamp casts a halo around his big stuffed chair. Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking. I'm 4 or 5. Was he already drinking? With its tip and knuckle between his thumb and finger, he'll pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking. Stop, Daddy, stop. It was more like screeching. And kneels down before him on the hardwood floor. Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking. What happened to him that he'd do such a thing? It's only a game. He's doing me a favor to pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking, because the world will run over a weakling and we must crush the mouse or be crushed later. Be strong, be tough. It was my father speaking to himself, of course, to the child inside him aching, not to me. But how can I not go when he calls me over to pinch my pinky until the mouse starts squeaking? Be strong, be tough. It is my father speaking.
Poet Michael Ryan, recorded in 1989. Well, shortly after the broadcast, I got a phone call from a poet friend who told me that Ryan had a reputation as a womanizer and for coming on to his college students. That's a side of the sensitive poet that was hidden from me and obviously from our listeners. But that discomforting biographical insight was nothing compared to the shock of seeing Ryan's new memoir, in which he confesses that for most of his life he's been addicted to sex. He started seeking help and changing his life in 1990. His memoir, aptly titled Secret Life, was described in the Sunday New York Times Book Review as extraordinarily absorbing and disquieting. We invited Michael Ryan back to talk about it. I wanted to know what it was like to keep such a big secret from the people he met.
Well, it was horrible. I mean, now I'm happy to say what you see is what you get. But the real burden was on myself. That's why having a secret life, a shameful secret life, is self-destructive more than anything else. I mean, it can hurt other people, but it's mainly a self-punishment.
I find it really interesting that on the one hand, you were writing poetry that was very honest about the experiences that you chose to describe in poems.
Yes.
On the other hand, you had to lie a lot to people in order to not reveal really personal things about you.
Well, they were lies of omission, you know. So
you feel like you never describe things in a false way. You just didn't say what it was you were doing.
Nobody knew about them.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to write your autobiography, Secret Life, and to tell about your sexual obsession?
Yeah. Well, I had to get at this. I'd come to the end of the road with it. It was hurting me too much. It was, every addict is two people, I think. Every addict is both a human being and what I call in Secret Life this no-I driving me to be no one. and they're always in conflict. And it just came to a point where I'd caused too much damage and suffered too much damage to not deal with it explicitly. I had broken up, my second wife and I had broken up, and I had a contract to write a book of essays about poetry, and I was on the last essay, and I couldn't finish it. I had to turn to something that was going to deal with the causes of this chaos, and this was it.
I'd like you to read an excerpt of the very beginning of your memoir, Secret Life.
Okay. This is from the first chapter, the very beginning of the book, which is called Soul Sickness, and defines that condition, I think, for me. Every sex addict has his own thing, the thing he likes the most, although like is hardly the word for the inexorable pull I felt and sought and sometimes still feel, but with God's help one day at a time do not act on. It's as if an electronic magnet in my solar plexus were switched on. At its most intense, I'd go into a kind of trance, dissociated, beamed in from Mars, my mouth dry and my heart pounding, my usual waking consciousness hovering somewhere outside my body while I was taken by the pull. One of my partners once said to me, "You are like another person when we go into sex." That's how I put it, too. Go into sex. Any way I could get there was fine, but the best way was anonymous sex with a teenage girl, initiated by a secret touch. I spent most of my adult life in public watching for her, checking every prospect for what I called the look, pouting, furious, damaged, sullen, short skirts, tight jeans, halter tops, spike heel pumps. My primary loyalty was to sex. No human relationship took precedence over it, not marriage, not friendship, and certainly not ethics. Achievements were meaningless unless converted into sexual rewards.
In that reading, you say, you know, a former girlfriend said to you, "You're like another person when you go into sex." Did you think of yourself as being like another person when you were engaging in sex?
I think I thought of myself as being the real person when I was going into that state of mind. That just always seemed to me the truth. And I guess that's why that feeling is I first had when I was sexually molested. And sexuality was cast into that mold for me.
You were sexually molested by a young man in the neighborhood when you were five?
Five years old, yeah.
So what was the connection between what you felt when you were molested and what you thought was your true self when you were older and having sex?
I think it, you know, there was some sense in which that interaction, that state of being with another person was the truth. That was the truth. There was no other truth. Everything else was an approximation or an excuse for it or a sublimation of it or whatever. This was reality, and that's what I sought.
What kind of things turned you on? Were you into, you know, like sex and danger, or did you have any kind of specific types of obsessions?
I think, yeah, as I say in that passage, anonymity was the main thing. I mean, it was the more that I was known by somebody else, the less erotic it was to me.
So to keep it anonymous, did you have to have a lot of partners, keep changing partners?
You bet. Yeah.
And like how often, how many partners do you think you'd have
in a year? I really don't know. I haven't counted, but it was another part of the self-punishment to make that demand on myself, because that's very hard to do, you know, to get that kind of supply, again, to talk about it in terms of an addiction. to keep that supply going is really, really impossible.
You're a poet. You're really into the subtleties of language. Do you think it should be called sexual obsession instead of sexual addiction? There's something that troubles me about sexual addiction, and I've been trying to think of what is troubling to me about it. One is I think that it's equating it with, like, on a literal level with a drug, you know, like heroin or alcohol or something. And also that because it equates it with a drug, it kind of absolves the person of any responsibility in a way. You know, it's like a chemical thing that takes over. Sex seems different to me than, say, heroin.
Well, I think it's the latter part, the notion that it absolves one of responsibility that bothers people. But on the contrary, I think certainly myself and every addict is responsible for what he does. He's still a human being on the face of the earth. In terms of its differing from substance abuses, in my own opinion, though again, I don't care about convincing anyone else, there is no difference. It is an altered state. It was an altered state for me. And it was certainly my drug of choice.
You write, for each woman I seduced, there were two more I tried to seduce and 10 more I wanted to seduce but couldn't. So what I experienced most of the time was failure and frustration.
Right. That has to do with the notion of the unending supply and the difficulty of maintaining that.
So were you, in some ways, like an unfulfilled, unsuccessful addict?
I guess so. I mean, sure, every addict is unfulfilled and unsuccessful. There's just no way any addict in any substance can get enough of whatever it is that he wants.
You ask a very interesting question in your memoir. You say, how do you change your sexuality? How do you change what turns you on? Did you find an answer to that?
Yeah.
What?
Well, the 12-step program that I'm in provides me with an alternate way of being one day at a time. And I've learned through the cultivation of the kinds of spiritual values that are part of that program that it's possible to really take more joy in giving than getting, and that you just don't have to worry about what you get if you believe that it's supplied to you by a higher power.
But does that really answer the question of how do you change what turns you on?
Yes, because that changes me, again, one day at a time, and that changes everything. Whereas before, sex was the center of life to me. Now it's a part of life, and it's a blessing and a gift.
I think sexuality is one of those real mysteries of of human life, and a lot of people, I think, are really baffled why certain things that might turn them on in film or in literature or in fantasy, they wouldn't actually like in real life. You know, for a lot of people, there's this real split between their sexual fantasy world and their real sexual world. Was there ever a split for you, or did you merge those
that
two?
That was and just part of the problem, that there was anything that, and I believe I say this in the book, anything that I would fantasize, I would do. There was no distinction. In fact, not only would I do, I would have to do. I would feel impelled to do. I would feel obliged to do. That if I didn't do, I was somehow not strong, not powerful. That if I really wanted something, I should get it. I should be that strong. And it's an awful and outrageous way to live.
What about pornography? Have you ever read or watched much of that? And would you do it now, or would you consider it dangerous for you now?
I wouldn't do it now, just because that form of sexuality I associate with for me, again, not trying to speak for everyone, but just for me, would be toxic and not the kind of sexuality that makes me happy, now. I do have a lot of problems with pornography. I think most of it is used by sex addicts.
My guest is poet Michael Ryan. He's the author of the new memoir, Secret Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Ryan. His new memoir, Secret Life, is about his sexual obsession. One of the many things I didn't know about you when I interviewed you the first time around was that you were actually fired from Princeton in 1981.
Actually, it was suspended.
Suspended.
Yeah,
okay.
Suspended with pay.
Mm-hmm. What for what specifically?
It was for seducing one student and propositioning another.
Now, did word get out about you after that?
It certainly did. Yeah, that was very well known in the literary world and very humiliating experience for me because it made me the subject of a lot of conversations that were reported to me by people who I didn't know. And there were a lot of both true and false stories about it. I mean, I had a reputation before that, but that certainly solidified it.
How did it affect your career as a writer?
Well, that is hard to say. I didn't have a full-time teaching job, a permanent teaching job, for 10 years after that. I had part-time teaching, and whether it affected the way in which people read my work or not, I don't know. It probably did.
You're teaching now.
I am, yes.
Is it hard for you to be around young women when you teach?
No. If that situation ever arises, and my book ends with a situation in which it does arise, in which I am propositioned by one of my students, and I'm able to maintain that boundary between us, because without the maintenance of that boundary, again, speaking only for myself, the whole sense of the human value of the interaction is lost. And so it's really important that I not sleep with my students, so I don't.
Well, what happened to you in your life that made you think, I've got a problem and I want help?
Well, that's also, I write about that in the first chapter of the book. I was on my way to seduce the 15-year-old daughter of one of my friends, and I just realized that there was something really terribly wrong with me if this was something that I wanted to do so much.
So what'd you do after that?
Well, I turned around and I went back to Boston, which is where I was living, and I felt like blowing my brains out for quite some time. And I went to see a therapist, and the therapist again suggested that I go to a 12-step program, and so I started going to a 12-step program.
There's plenty of, say, tabloid TV shows that you could be a guest on, and at the bottom of the screen it would say, Michael Ryan, : sex addict.
Right.
And... do you think there's a difference between the kind of tabloid interest in other people's sexuality and other people's sexual problems? The difference between that and what you've tried to do in your memoir?
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. I mean, what I tried to do in this book is render my life. I mean, it's a simplification, necessarily so. The book does not contain everybody that I knew or everything that I did, but it contains a certain narrative and it contains a certain argument, and what that wants to do is render something in a significant way with as much complexity within the simplification as possible. That's wholly different from the way in which this subject might be treated by a tabloid TV show.
Let me ask you a question that I realize might make you uncomfortable. But when you meet people for the first time now who know you through your memoir about sexual obsession, do you think that they're, especially women, uncomfortable around you and thinking like, oh no, am I turning him on? Is he staring at my body? you know what I mean.
Yeah. I don't know. Again, it's very fresh. The book has only been in the bookstores for 2 weeks. People's response has been remarkably generous. I mean, the people that I know, it's not been judgmental. It hasn't been, oh, you freak, you weirdo, you pervert. It has been, oh, you human being, oh, you sufferer, oh, you wrote something wonderful about it. So, so far, the experience has been a wonderfully healing and rewarding experience.
But has it brought a new level of self-consciousness to your interactions with people?
No, again, what would be the case anyway, whether I wrote this book or not, I hope what would be what you see is what you get. I mean, I'm here. And I don't have to hide anything anymore. And that's a great relief. But writing this book was part of the agency for coming to this sense of being about myself. So I don't think it could have happened otherwise. I feel terrifically healed by it. It has changed me.
Michael Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Ryan has written a new memoir called Secret Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.